Albert Einstein had written in 1939, and anyone who thinks about the future must live in fear and terror. And yet the fevered dream for world peace remained and seemed to many less a fantasy and closer to reality when on June 25th, Truman attended the founding conference of the United Nations in San Francisco. Delegates from 50 nations signed a charter that Truman called a victory against war itself. The American experiment, begun at the height of the Enlightenment, was to see a new day. Let us not fail to grasp this supreme chance to establish a worldwide rule of reason, Truman said, to create an enduring peace under the guidance of God. As the conference closed, Acting Secretary General Alger Hist boarded an Army transport plane along with this cherished treasure, the United Nations Charter, locked in a 75-pound safe attached to a parachute that read, "Finder, do not open. Send to the Department of State, Washington." The United States, a nation founded in an act of severing, had tied its fate to the fate of the world. A nation that had refused to join the League of Nations had taken the lead in establishing its replacement. It remained to be seen whether the moment would be fleeting or lasting, but it had been long in coming. The Depression, the New Deal, and Roosevelt's political rhetoric had taught Americans about the danger of an island. We have learned that we cannot live alone at peace, that our own well-being is dependent on the well-being of other nations far away, Roosevelt had said in 1933 in his first inaugural address. We have learned the simple truth, as Emerson said, that the only way to have a friend is to be one. And the millions of American sailors and soldiers and nurses and airmen who fought on all four corners of the globe gained a cosmopolitanism unknown to any previous generation of Americans. One GI, a corporal with a rural background, told Yank magazine that before the war, I never got more than 15 miles from home. But the Army's taken me through 15 countries, from Brazil to Iceland, from Trinidad to Czechoslovakia. In July 1945, the Office of War Information drafted America in the World, a statement unimaginable in any other era in American history. In this interdependent world, there is no region in which the United States can renounce its moral and ideological interest. Truman, meanwhile, faced a dire decision about how to end the war in Japan. In June 1945, Leo Szilard wrote to Truman, urging him against deploying the atomic bomb. A nation which sets the precedent of using any of these newly liberated forces of nature for purposes of destruction may have to bear the responsibility of opening the door to an era of devastation on an unimaginable scale. Szilard was a great admirer of H.G. Wells, who'd predicted atomic warfare in a novel published in the dark days of 1914. Wells had imagined an atomic world of tomorrow. Power after power about the armed globe sought to anticipate attack by aggression. They went to war in a delirium of panic in order to use their bombs first, Wells wrote in his novel. By the spring of 1959, from nearly 200 centers and every week added to their number, roared the unquenchable crimson conflagrations of the atomic bombs. The flimsy fabric of the world's credit had vanished. Industry was completely disorganized, and every city, every thickly populated area, was starving or trembled on the verge of starvation. Szilard, fearing that Wells's long-ago predicted dystopia was at hand, began gathering signatures to send Truman. When the military threatened to charge Szilard with espionage, Robert Oppenheimer decided to delay sending the petition. But Szilard pressed on, and by July 17th, 70 scientists working on the Manhattan Project, having witnessed the first test of the atomic bomb, had signed his petition of protest. Outside of those scientists, the president, and a handful of military men with clearance, Americans did not know about the existence of the atomic bomb. But they who knew, knew fear. Weapons capable of destroying cities or even humanity itself had been the stuff of science fiction for decades. And the scale of destruction between the First World War and the Second augured nothing so much as yet more staggering destructive force. Archibald MacLeish tapped into this fear in a campaign he waged to raise popular support for the United Nations. He arranged for so many pro-United Nations radio broadcasts that journalist and former America Firster John T. Flynn complained, "You can't turn on the radio at any hour of the day, morning, noon, or night, whether you listen to the Metropolitan Opera or to a horse opera, a hillbilly ballad, a commentator, or a newscaster, that you do not hear a plug for this great instrument of peace." MacLeish's most powerful project was Watchtower Over Tomorrow, a 15-minute film screened at movie theaters across the country, queued up with the newsreels that appeared before feature films. Directed by Alfred Hitchcock, Watchtower Over Tomorrow opened with footage that Hitchcock took from a 1936 science fiction film, Things to Come, an adaptation of yet another dystopian novel written by Wells, which imagined a decades-long war and a new machine age in which a race of super scientists have built a space gun. In the footage used by Hitchcock, a giant crane lowers a bomb into the barrel of a giant missile that, launched in a giant cloud of dust, reaches the stars before falling to Earth and exploding. Death from the sky from a bomb fired by an enemy thousands of miles away, the bomb which could be the opening of World War III, a narrator says. It is to prevent the firing of such a bomb that we of the United Nations have struggled on the Italian front, the Western front, the Eastern front, throughout the Balkans, halfway around the world, in China, in Burma, in the Atlantic, up and down the Pacific, wherever the enemy can be brought to bay, to make possible a peace more permanent than a breathing spell between devastating wars. Watchtower Over Tomorrow began appearing in theaters in the spring of 1945. The future that it imagined the United Nations would stop came all the same. That summer, on August 6th, the United States dropped an atomic bomb on Hiroshima. 3 days later, it dropped another on Nagasaki. Japan surrendered. "This is the greatest thing in history," Truman said. The Second World War had ended, and Watchtower or no, an altogether new tomorrow had begun. Part 4. The Machine, 1946 to 2016. Our challenges may be new, the instruments with which we meet them may be new, but those values upon which our success depends, honesty and hard work, courage and fair play, tolerance and curiosity, loyalty and patriotism, these things are old. These things are true. They have been the quiet force of progress throughout our history. What is demanded, then, is a return to these truths. Barack Obama, First Inaugural Address, 2009. Chapter 13, A World of Knowledge. The end of time began at 8:15 on the morning of August 6th, 1945. Miss Toshiko Sasaki, a clerk in the personnel department of the East Asia Tin Works, had just sat down to her place in the plant office and was turning her head to speak to the girl at the next desk, the writer John Hersey reported in The New Yorker. Just as she turned her head away from the windows, the room was filled with a blinding light. She was paralyzed by fear, fixed still in her chair for a long moment. Everything fell, and Miss Sasaki lost consciousness. The ceiling dropped suddenly, and the wooden floor above collapsed in splinters, and the people up there came down, and the roof above them gave way. But principally and first of all, the bookcases right behind her swooped forward, and the contents threw her down, with her left leg horribly twisted and breaking underneath her. There, in the tin factory, in the first moment of the atomic age, a human being was crushed by books. In the first moment of the atomic age, a human being was crushed by books, the violence of knowledge. Hiroshima marked the beginning of a new and differently unstable political era, in which technological change wildly outpaced the human capacity for moral reckoning. It wasn't only the bomb and the devastation it wreaked. It was the computers whose development had made dropping the bomb possible. And it was the force of technological change itself, a political power unchecked by an 18th-century constitution and unfathomed by a 19th-century faith in progress. Truman got word of the bombing on board a cruiser. The White House told the press the next day. The story went out over the radio at noon. Listeners reeled. John Haynes Holmes, a Unitarian minister and avowed pacifist, was on vacation at a cottage in Kennebunk, Maine. "Everything else seems suddenly to become insignificant," he said about how he felt when he heard the news. "I seemed to grow cold, as though I'd been transported to the waste spaces of the moon." Days later, when the Japanese were forced to surrender, Americans celebrated. In St. Louis, people drove around the city with tin cans tied to the bumpers of their cars. In San Francisco, they tugged trolley cars off their tracks. More than 400,000 Americans had died in a war that worldwide had taken the lives of some 60 million people. And yet, however elated at the peace, Americans worried about how the war had ended. There was a special horror in the split second that returned so many thousand humans to the primeval dust from which they sprang, one Newsweek editorial read. For a race which still did not entirely understand steam and electricity, it was natural to say, "Who next?" Doubts gathered and grew. Seldom, if ever, has a war ended, leaving the victors with such a sense of uncertainty and fear, CBS's Edward R. Murrow said. "We know what the bombs did to Hiroshima and Nagasaki," wrote the editors of Fortune. "But what did they do to the U.S. mind?" Part of the uncertainty was a consequence of the surprise. Americans hadn't known about the bomb before it fell. The Manhattan Project was classified. Even Truman hadn't known about it until after FDR's death. Nor had Americans known about the computers the military had been building. Research that had also been classified, but which was dramatically revealed the winter after the war. "One of the war's top secrets, an amazing machine which applies electronic speeds for the first time to mathematical tasks, hitherto too difficult and cumbersome for solutions, was announced here tonight by the War Department," the New York Times reported from Philadelphia on February 15, 1946, in a front-page story introducing ENIAC, the Electronic, Numerical, Integrator, and Computer, the first general-purpose electronic digital computer. Inside, the Times ran a full-page spread, including a photograph of the computer, the size of a room. It was as if the curtain had been lifted, a magician's veil. Like the atomic bomb, ENIAC was produced by the American military to advance the cause of war and relied on breakthroughs made by scientists in other parts of the world. In 1936, the English mathematician Alan Turing completed a PhD at Princeton and wrote a paper called On Computable Numbers, in which he predicted the possibility of inventing a single machine that can be used to compute any computable sequence. The next year, Howard Aiken, a doctoral student at Harvard, poking around in the attic of the Harvard Science Building, found a model of Charles Babbage's early 19th century difference engine. Aiken then proposed to IBM to build a new and better version, not mechanical, but electronic. That project began at IBM in 1941, and 3 years later moved to Harvard, where Aiken, now a naval officer, was in charge of the machine known as Mark I. Columbia astronomer L.J. Comrie called it Babbage's dream come true. The Mark I was programmed by a longtime Vassar professor, the brilliant mathematician Grace Murray Hopper. Amazing Grace, her colleagues nicknamed her. And she understood, maybe better than anyone, how far-reaching were the implications of a programmable computer. As she would explain, "It is the current aim to replace, as far as possible, the human brain." During the war, the Allied military had been interested in computers for two primary reasons: to break codes and to calculate weapons trajectories. At Bletchley Park, a 600-acre manorial estate 50 miles northwest of London that became a secret military facility, Turing, who would later be prosecuted for homosexuality and die of cyanide poisoning, had by 1940 built a single-purpose computer able to break down the codes devised by Germany's Enigma machine. At the University of Pennsylvania, physicist John Mauchly and electrical engineer Presper Eckert had been charged with calculating firing angle settings for artillery, work that required iterative and time-consuming calculations. To do that work, American scientists had been using an analog computer called a differential analyzer, invented at MIT in 1931 by FDR research czar Vannevar Bush, an electrical engineer. Numbers were entered into the differential analyzer by people who are known as computers and who are usually women with mathematical degrees, not unlike the checkers, women with literature degrees who worked at magazines. But even when these women entered numbers around the clock, it took a month to generate a single artillery trajectory table. In August 1942, Mauchly proposed using vacuum tubes to build a digital electronic computer that would be much faster. The U.S. War Department decided on April 9, 1943, to fund it. Construction of ENIAC began in June 1943, but it wasn't fully operational until July 1945. ENIAC could make calculations 100 times faster than any earlier machine. Its first assignment in the fall of 1945 came from Los Alamos. Using nearly a million punch cards, each prepared and entered into the machine by a team of female programmers, ENIAC calculated the force of reactions in a fusion reaction for the purpose of devising a hydrogen bomb. The machines built to plot the trajectories and force of missiles and bombs would come to transform economic systems, social structures, and the workings of politics. Computers are often left out of the study of history and government. But starting at the end of the Second World War, history and government cannot be understood without them. Democracies rely on an informed electorate. Computers, the product of long and deep study and experiment, would both explode and unsettle the very nature of knowledge. The boundlessness of scientific inquiry also challenged the boundaries of the nation-state. After the war, scientists were among the loudest constituencies calling for international cooperation and, in particular, for a means by which atomic war could be averted. Instead, their work was conscripted into the Cold War. The decision to lift the veil of secrecy and display ENIAC to the public came at a moment when the nation was engaged in a heated debate about the role of the federal government in supporting scientific research. During the war, at the urging of Vannevar Bush, FDR had created both the National Defense Research Committee and the Office of Scientific Research and Development. Bush headed both. Near the end of the war, Roosevelt had asked Bush to prepare a report that in July 1945, Bush submitted to Truman. It was called Science, the Endless Frontier. A nation which depends upon others for its new basic scientific knowledge will be slow in its industrial progress and weak in its competitive position in world trade, Bush warned. Advances in science, when put to practical use, mean more jobs, higher wages, shorter hours, more abundant crops, more leisure for recreation, for study, for learning how to live without the deadening drudgery, which has been the burden of common man for ages past. At Bush's urging, Congress debated a bill to establish a new federal agency, the National Science Foundation. Critics said the bill tied university research to the military and to business interests, and asked whether scientists had not been chastened by the bomb. Scientific advances did indeed relieve people of drudgery and produce wealth and leisure. But the history of the last century had shown nothing, if not that these benefits were spread so unevenly as to cause widespread political unrest and even revolution. The project of Progressive and New Deal reformers had been to protect the interests of those left behind by providing government supports and regulations. Could this practice be applied to the federal government's relationship to science? Democratic Senator Harley M. Kilgore, a former schoolteacher from West Virginia, introduced a rival bill that extended the anti-monopoly principles of the New Deal to science, tied university research to government planning, and included in the new foundation a division of social science to provide funding for research designed to solve social and economic problems on the grounds that one kind of knowledge had gotten ahead of another. Human beings had learned how to destroy the entire planet, but had not learned how to live together in peace. During Senate hearings, former Vice President Henry Wallace said, "It is only by pursuing the field of the social sciences comprehensively that the world could avoid bigger and worse wars." Many scientists, including those who belonged to the newly formed Federation of Atomic Scientists, agreed, and two rivulets of protests became a stream. A revision of Kilgore's bill was attached to a bill calling for civilian control of atomic power. Atomic scientists launched a campaign to enlist the support of the public. "To the village square, we must carry the facts of atomic energy," Albert Einstein said. "From there must come America's voice." Atomic scientists spoke at Kiwanis clubs, at churches and at synagogues, at schools and libraries. In Kansas alone, they held 8 atomic age conferences. And they published One World or None, a report to the public on the full meaning of the atomic bomb. Essays by atomic scientists, including Leo Szilard and Robert Oppenheimer, and by political commentators, including Walter Lippmann. Albert Einstein, in his essay, argued for denationalization. Against this campaign stood advocates for federal government funding of the new field of computer science, who launched their own publicity campaigns, beginning with the well-staged unveiling of ENIAC. It had been difficult to stir up interest. No demonstration of a general-purpose computer could have the drama of an atomic explosion, or even of the 1939 World's Fair's chain-smoking Electro the Moto Man. ENIAC was inert. Its vacuum tubes, lit by dim neon bulbs, were barely visible. When the machine was working, there was no real way to see much of anything happening. Mauchly and Eckert prepared press releases and, in advance of a scheduled press conference, tricked up the machine for dramatic effect. Eckert cut ping-pong balls in half, wrote numbers on them, and placed them over the tips of the bulbs, so that when the machine was working, the room flashed as the lights flickered and blinked. It blinked fast. The Times gushed, "The ENIAC, as the new electronic speed marvel is known, virtually eliminates time." the unintended consequences of the elimination of time would be felt for generations. But the great acceleration, the speeding up of every exchange, had begun, and so had the great atomization, the turning of citizens into pieces of data, fed into machines, tabulated, processed, and targeted, as the nation-state began to yield to the data-state. 1. The end of the war marked the dawn of an age of affluence, a wide and deep American prosperity. It led both to a new direction for liberalism, away from an argument for government regulation of business, and toward an insistence on individual rights, and to a new form of conservatism, dedicated to the fight against communism, and deploying to new ends the rhetoric of freedom. The origins of post-war prosperity lay in the last legislative act of the New Deal. In June 1944, FDR had signed the Servicemen's Readjustment Act, better known as the GI Bill of Rights. It created a veterans-only welfare state. The GI Bill extended to the 16 million Americans who served in the war a series of benefits, including a free 4-year college education, zero down payment, low-interest loans for homes and businesses, and a readjustment benefit of $20 a week for up to 52 weeks to allow returning veterans to find work. More than half of eligible veterans, some 8 million Americans, took advantage of the GI Bill's educational benefits. Those who did enjoyed average earnings of $10,000 to $15,000 more than those who didn't. They also paid more in taxes. By 1948, the cost of the GI Bill constituted 15% of the federal budget, but with rising tax revenues, the GI Bill paid for itself almost 10 times over. It created a new middle class, changed the face of American colleges and universities, and convinced many Americans that the prospects for economic growth, for each generation's achieving a standard of living higher than the generation before, might be limitless. That growth was achieved in part by consumer spending, as factories outfitted for wartime production were converted to manufacture consumer goods, from roller skates to color televisions. The idea of the citizen as a consumer and of spending as an act of citizenship dates to the 1920s. But in the 1950s, mass consumption became a matter of civic obligation. By buying the dozens of things you never bought or even thought of before, Brides Magazine told its readers, you are helping to build greater security for the industries of this country. Critics suggested that the banality and conformity of consumer society had reduced Americans to robots. John Updike despaired. I drive my car to supermarket. The way I take is super high. A super lot is where I park it. And super suds are what I buy. Nothing epitomized what critics called the packaged society, so much as Disneyland, an amusement park that had opened in 1955 as a reimagined 1939 World's Fair, more provincial and more commercial, with a Main Street and a Tomorrowland. In Frontierland, Walt Disney explained, visitors can return to Frontier America, from the Revolutionary era to the final taming of the Great Southwest, riding stagecoaches and Conestoga wagons over dusty trails, and boarding the steamship Mark Twain, within sight of the park's trademark turquoise-towered castle, a fairyland that sold itself as the happiest place on earth. Most of the buying was done by women, housewives, and mothers. The home, which had become separated from work during the process of industrialization, became a new kind of political space in which women met the obligations of citizenship by spending money. Domesticity itself took on a different cast, as changes to the structure of the family that had begun in the Depression and continued during the war were reversed. Before the war, age at first marriage had been rising. After the war, it began falling. The number of children per family had been falling. It began rising. More married women and mothers of young children had been entering the paid labor force. They began leaving it. Having bigger families felt, to many Americans, an urgent matter. After the Holocaust, we felt obligated to have a lot of babies, one Jewish mother later explained. But it was easy because everyone was doing it, non-Jews too. Expectations of equality between men and women within marriage diminished, as did expectations of political equality. Claims for equal rights for women had been strenuously pressed during the war, but afterwards they were mostly abandoned. In 1940, the GOP had supported the Equal Rights Amendment, first introduced into Congress in 1923, and in 1944, the Democrats had supported it, too. The measure reached the Senate in 1946, where it won a plurality but fell short of the two-thirds vote required to send the amendment to the states for ratification. It would not pass Congress until 1972, after which an army of housewives, the foot soldiers of the conservative movement, would block its ratification. The GI Bill, for all that it did to build a new middle class, also reproduced and even exacerbated earlier forms of social and economic inequality. Most women who had served in the war were not eligible for benefits. The women's auxiliary divisions of the branches of the military had been deliberately decreed to be civilian units, with an eye toward avoiding providing veterans' benefits to women, on the assumption that they would be supported by men. After the war, when male veterans flocked to colleges and universities, many schools stopped admitting women or reduced their number in order to make room for men. And even among veterans, the bill's benefits were applied unevenly. Some 5,000 soldiers and 4,000 sailors had been given a blue discharge during the war as suspected homosexuals. The VA's interpretation of that discharge made them ineligible for any GI Bill benefits. African-American veterans were excluded from veterans organizations, they faced hostility and violence, and most significantly, they were barred from taking advantage of the GI Bill's signal benefits, its education and housing provisions. In some states, the American Legion, the most powerful veterans association, refused to admit African-Americans and proved unwilling to recognize desegregated associations. Money to go to college was hard to use when most colleges and universities refused to admit African Americans, and historically black colleges and universities had a limited number of seats. The University of Pennsylvania had 9,000 students in 1946. Only 46 were black. By 1946, some 100,000 black veterans had applied for educational benefits. Only 1 in 5 had been able to register for college. More than 1 in 4 veterans took advantage of the GI Bill's home loans, which meant that by 1956, 42% of World War II veterans owned their own homes, compared to only 34% of non-veterans. But the bill's easy access to credit and capital was far less available to black veterans. Banks refused to give black veterans loans, and restrictive covenants and redlining meant that much new housing was whites only. Even after the Supreme Court struck down restrictive housing covenants in 1948, the Federal Housing Administration followed a policy of segregation, routinely denying loans to both blacks and Jews. In cities like Chicago and St. Louis and Los Angeles and Detroit, racially restrictive covenants in housing created segregated ghettos, where few had existed before the war. Whites got loans, had their housing offers accepted, and moved to the suburbs. Blacks were crowded into bounded neighborhoods within the city. 13 million new homes were built in the United States during the 1950s. 11 million of them were built in the suburbs. 83% of all population growth in the 1950s took place in the suburbs. For every 2 blacks who moved to the cities, 3 whites moved out. The post-war racial order created a segregated landscape. Black cities, white suburbs. The New Deal's unfinished business, its inattention to racial discrimination and racial violence, became the business of the post-war civil rights movement, as new forms of discrimination and the persistence of Jim Crow laws and even of lynching. In 1946 and 1947, black veterans were lynched in Georgia and Louisiana, contributed to a new depth of discontent. As a black corporal from Alabama put it, "I spent 4 years in the Army to free a bunch of Dutchmen and Frenchmen, and I'm hanged if I'm going to let the Alabama version of the Germans kick me around when I get home." Langston Hughes, who wrote a regular column for the Chicago Defender, urged black Americans to try to break Jim Crow laws at lunch counters. "Folks, when you go to the South by train, be sure to eat in the diner," Hughes wrote. "Even if you're not hungry, eat anyhow, to help establish that right." But where Roosevelt had turned a blind eye, Truman did not. He'd grown up in Independence, Missouri, just outside Kansas City, and worked on the family farm until the First World War, when he saw combat in France. Back in Missouri, he began a slow ascension through the Democratic Party ranks, starting with a county office and rising to the U.S. Senate in 1934. Roosevelt had chosen him as his running mate in 1944 chiefly because he was unobjectionable. Neither wing of the Democratic Party was troubled by Truman. He'd played virtually no role in White House affairs during his vice presidency and was little prepared to move into the Oval Office upon Roosevelt's death. No president had faced a greater trial by fire than the decision that had fallen to Truman over whether or not to use the atomic bomb. Mild-mannered and myopic, Truman had a common touch. Unlike most American presidents, he had neither a college degree nor a law degree. For all his limitations as a president, he had an intuitive sense of the concerns of ordinary Americans, and from the very beginning of his career, he'd courted black voters and worked closely with black politicians. Unwilling to ignore Jim Crow, Truman established a commission on civil rights. "To secure these rights," its 1947 report, demonstrated that a new national consensus had been reached, pointing to a conviction that the federal government does more than prevent the abuse of rights, but also secures rights. From the earliest moments of our history, we have believed that every human being has an essential dignity and integrity which must be secured and safeguarded, read the report. The United States can no longer countenance these burdens on its common conscience. Consistent with that commitment, Truman made national health insurance his first domestic policy priority. In September 1945, he asked Congress to act on FDR's Second Bill of Rights by passing what came to be called a fair deal. Its centerpiece was a call for a universal medical insurance. The time seemed finally right, and Truman enjoyed some important sources of bipartisan support, including from Earl Warren, the Republican governor of California. What Truman proposed was a national version of a plan Warren had proposed in California, compulsory insurance funded with a payroll tax. The health of American children, like their education, should be recognized as a definite public responsibility, the president said. Warren, the son of a Norwegian immigrant railroad worker, a striker who was later murdered, had grown up knowing hardship. After studying political science and the law at Berkeley and serving during the First World War, he'd become California's attorney general in 1939. In that position, he'd been a strong supporter of the Japanese-American internment policy. If the Japs are released, Warren had warned, no one will be able to tell a saboteur from any other Jap. Warren later publicly expressed pained remorse about this policy, and in a 1972 interview, wept over it. On the strength of his record as attorney general, Warren had run for governor in 1942. Clem Whitaker and Leon Baxter had managed his campaign, which had been notoriously heated. Wartime voters live at an emotional pitch that is anything but normal, Whitaker had written in his plan of campaign. This must be a campaign that makes people hear the beat of drums and the thunder of bombs, a campaign that stirs and captures the imagination, a campaign that no one who loves California can disregard. This must be a call to arms in defense of California. Warren won, but he didn't like how he'd won. Just before the election, he fired Whitaker and Baxter. They never forgave him. Late in 1944, Warren had fallen seriously ill with a kidney infection. His treatment required heroic and costly medical intervention. He began to consider the catastrophic effects a sudden illness could have on a family of limited means. I came to the conclusion that the only way to remedy this situation was to spread the cost through insurance, he later wrote. He asked his staff to develop a proposal. After conferring with the California Medical Association, he anticipated no objections from doctors. And so, in his January 1945 State of the State address, Warren announced his plan, a proposal modeled on the Social Security system. A 1.5% withholding of wages would contribute to a statewide compulsory insurance program. And then, the California Medical Association hired Campaigns, Inc. Earl Warren began his political career as a conservative and ended it as a liberal. Years later, Leon Baxter was asked by a historian what she made of Warren's seeming transformation. Warren's own explanation, the historian told Baxter, was this. I grew up a poor boy myself, and I saw the trials and tribulations of getting old without having any income, and being sick, and not being able to work. Baxter shot back. He didn't see them until that Sunday in 1945. Then she ended the interview. What really changed Earl Warren was Campaigns, Inc. Whitaker and Baxter took a piece of legislation that enjoyed wide popular support and torpedoed it. 50 newspapers initially supported Warren's plan. Whitaker and Baxter whittled that down to 20. You can't beat something with nothing, Whitaker liked to say. So they launched a drive for private health insurance, their voluntary health insurance week, driven by 40,000 inches of advertising and more than 400 newspapers, was observed in 53 of the state's 58 counties. Whitaker and Baxter sent more than 9,000 doctors out with prepared speeches. They coined a slogan, "Political medicine is bad medicine." They printed postcards for voters to stick in the mail. Dear Senator, please vote against all compulsory health insurance bills pending before the legislature. We have enough regimentation in this country now. Certainly, we don't want to be forced to go to a state doctor or to pay for such a doctor, whether we use him or not. That system was born in Germany, and it is part and parcel of what our boys are fighting overseas. Let's not adopt it here. When Warren's bill failed to pass by just one vote, he blamed Whitaker and Baxter. They stormed the legislature with their invective, he complained, and my bill was not even accorded a decent burial. It was the greatest legislative victory at the hands of ad men the country had ever seen. It would not be the last. 2. Richard Milhouse Nixon counted his resentments the way other men count their conquests. Born in the sage and cactus town of Yorba Linda, California, in 1913, he'd been a nervous kid, a whip-smart striver. His family moved to Whittier, where his father ran a grocery store out of an abandoned church. Nixon went to Whittier College, working to pay his way, resenting that he didn't have the money to go somewhere else. He had wavy black hair, small dark eyes, and heavy, brooding eyebrows. An ace debater, he'd gone after college to Duke Law School, resented all the Wall Street law firms that refused to hire him when he finished, and returned to Whittier. He went away again to serve in the Navy in the South Pacific. And when he got back, serious and strenuously intelligent Lieutenant Commander Nixon, 32, was recruited by a group of California bankers and oilmen to try to defeat five-term Democratic incumbent Jerry Voorhees for a seat in the House. The man from Whittier wanted to go to Washington. Voorhees, a product of Hotchkiss and Yale and a veteran of Upton Sinclair's epic campaign, was a New Dealer who'd first been elected to Congress in 1936. But 10 years later, the New Deal was old news. The midterm elections during Truman's first term and the fate of his legislative agenda were tied to heightening tensions between the United States and the Soviet Union. Nixon in California was only one in a small battalion of younger men, mainly ex-servicemen, who ran for office in 1946, the nation's first Cold Warriors. In Massachusetts, another veteran of the war in the Pacific, 29-year-old John F. Kennedy, ran for a House seat from the 11th District. But unlike Nixon, he'd been readied for that seat from the cradle. Kennedy, born to wealth and groomed at Choate and Harvard, represented everything Nixon detested. All that Nixon had fought for, by tooth and claw, had been handed to Kennedy on a platter decorated with a doily. But both Nixon and Kennedy were powerfully shaped by the rising conflict with the Soviet Union, and both understood domestic affairs through the lens of foreign policy. After Stalin broke the promises he'd made at Yalta to allow Poland free and unfettered elections, it had become clear that he was ruthless, even if the West had as yet little knowledge of the purges with which he was overseeing the murder of millions of people. Inside the Truman administration, a conviction grew that the Soviet regime was ideologically and militarily relentless. In February 1946, George Kennan, an American diplomat in Moscow, sent the State Department an 8,000-word telegram in which he reported that the Soviets were resolute in their determination to battle the West in an epic confrontation between capitalism and communism. "We have here a political force committed fanatically to the belief that with the U.S. there can be no permanent modus vivendi, and it is desirable and necessary that the internal harmony of our society be disrupted, our traditional way of life be destroyed, the international authority of our state be broken, if Soviet power is to be secure," Kennan wrote. "This political force has complete power of disposition over energies of one of the world's greatest peoples and resources of world's richest national territory, and is borne along by deep and powerful currents of Russian nationalism." 2 weeks later, Winston Churchill, speaking in Truman's home state of Missouri, warned of an iron curtain falling across Europe. The post-war peace had been fleeting. As keenly as Roosevelt and Churchill had wanted to avoid repeating the mistakes of the peace made at the end of the First World War, political instability had inevitably trailed behind the devastation of the Second World War. The Soviet Union's losses had been staggering. 27 million Russians died, 90 times as many casualties as were suffered by Americans. Much of Europe and Asia had been ravaged. From ashes and ruins and graveyards, new regimes gathered. In Latin America, Africa, and South Asia, nations and peoples that had been colonized by European powers began to fight to secure their independence. They meant to choose their own political and economic arrangements. But in a newly bipolar world, that generally meant choosing between democracy and authoritarianism, between capitalism and communism, between the influence of the United States and the influence of the USSR. At the present moment in world history, nearly every nation must choose between alternative ways of life, Truman said. He conceived of a choice between freedom and oppression. Much about this conception, derived from the history of the United States, a refiguring of the struggle between freedom and slavery that had divided 19th century America into free states and slave states, and during which opponents of slavery had sought to contain it by refusing to admit slave states into the Union. In the late 1940s, Americans began applying this rhetoric internationally, pursuing a policy of containing communism while defending the free world. The same rhetoric, of course, infused domestic politics. Republicans characterized the 1946 midterm elections as involving a stark choice, Americanism versus communism. In California, scrappy Richard Nixon defeated the diffident Voorhees by debating him on a stage a half dozen times, but especially by painting him as weak on communism, and slaughtering him with innuendo and smear. Nixon adopted in his first campaign his signature tactic, making false claims and then taking umbrage when his opponent impugned his integrity. Voorhees was blindsided. "Every time I would say that something wasn't true," he recalled, "the response was always, 'Voorhees is using unfair tactics by accusing Dick Nixon of lying.'" But Nixon, the lunch bucket candidate, also exploited voters' unease with a distant government run by Ivy League-educated bureaucrats. He found it took only the merest of gestures to convince voters that there was something un-American about people like Voorhees, people like them. His campaign motto, "Richard Nixon is one of us." In November 1946, the GOP won both House and Senate for the first time since 1932. The few Democrats who were elected, like Kennedy in Massachusetts, had sounded the same themes as Nixon. The United States was soft on communism. As freshman congressmen, Kennedy and Nixon struck up an unlikely friendship while serving together on the House Education and Labor Committee. Nixon and his fellow Republicans supported a proposed Taft-Hartley Act, regulating the unions and prohibiting certain kinds of strikes and boycotts, an attempt to rein in the power of unions whose membership had surged before the war from 3 million in 1933 to more than 10 million in 1941. After Pearl Harbor, the AFL and the CIO had promised to abstain from striking for the duration of the conflict and agreed to wage limits. As soon as the war ended, though, the strikes began. Some 5 million workers walked out in 1946 alone. Truman opposed Taft-Hartley, and when Congress passed it, Truman vetoed it. Republicans in Congress began lining up votes for an override. Nixon and Kennedy went to a steel town in western Pennsylvania to debate the question before an audience of union leaders and businessmen. Each man admired the other's style. On the train back to Washington, they shared a sleeping car. Kennedy's half-hearted objections would, in any case, hold no sway against Republicans, who succeeded in depicting unionism as creeping communism. Congress overrode the president's veto. On foreign policy, Truman began to move to the right. Disavowing the legacy of American isolationism, he pledged that the nation would aid any besieged democracy. The immediate cause of this commitment was Britain's decision to stop providing aid to Greece and Turkey, which were struggling against communism. In March of 1947, the president announced what came to be called the Truman Doctrine. The United States would support free peoples who were resisting subjugation by armed minorities or by outside pressures. Truman aides later said that the president himself was unpersuaded by the growing fear of communism, but was instead concerned about his chances for re-election. "The president didn't attach fundamental importance to the so-called communist scare," one said. "He thought it was a lot of baloney." He also urged passage of the Marshall Plan, which provided billions of dollars in aid for rebuilding Western Europe. The Truman Doctrine and the Marshall Plan, the president liked to say, were two halves of the same walnut. Abroad, the United States would provide aid. At home, it would root out suspected communists. Coining a phrase, the financier and presidential advisor Bernard Baruch in April 1947 said in a speech in South Carolina, "We are today in the midst of a Cold War." Instead of a welfare state, the United States built a national security state. A peace dividend expected after the Allied victory in 1945 never came. Instead came the fight to contain communism, unprecedented military spending, and a new military bureaucracy. During Senate hearings on the future of the national defense, military contractors, including Lockheed, which had been an object of congressional investigation in the Merchants of Death era of the 1930s and had built tens of thousands of aircraft during the Second World War, argued that the nation required adequate, continuous, and permanent funding for military production, pressing not only for military expansion, but also for federal government subsidies. In 1940, when Roosevelt pledged to make the United States an arsenal of democracy, he meant wartime production. A central political question of post-war American politics would become whether the arsenal was, in fact, compatible with democracy. After the war, the United States committed itself to military supremacy in peacetime, not only through weapons manufacture and an expanded military, but through new institutions. In 1946, the Standing Committees on Military and Naval Affairs combined to become the Armed Services Committee. The 1947 National Security Act established the Central Intelligence Agency and the National Security Agency, created the position of the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and made the War Department, now housed for the first time in a building of its own, into the Department of Defense. In this political climate, the one-world vision of atomic scientists, along with the idea of civilian international control of atomic power, faded fast. Henry Stimson urged the sharing of atomic secrets. "The chief lesson I have learned in a long life," he said, is the only way you can make a man trustworthy is to trust him. And the surest way you can make a man untrustworthy is to distrust him and show him your distrust. Truman disagreed. Atomic secrets were to be kept secret, and the apparatus of espionage was to be deployed to ferret out scientists who might dissent from that view. The Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists began publishing a doomsday clock, an assessment of the time left before the world would be annihilated in an atomic war. In 1947, they set the clock at 7 minutes before midnight. Kennan, in a top-secret memo to Truman, warned that to use an atomic or hydrogen bomb would be to turn back time. These weapons, Kennan argued, reach backward beyond the frontiers of Western civilization. They cannot really be reconciled with a political purpose directed to shaping rather than destroying the lives of the adversary. They fail to take into account the ultimate responsibility of men for one another. No caution slowed the development of the weapons program, and Soviet aggression and espionage, along with events in China, aided the case for national security and undercut the argument of anyone who attempted to oppose the military buildup. With every step of communist advance, the United States sought out new alliances, strengthened its defenses, and increased military spending. In 1948, the Soviet-supported Communist Party in Czechoslovakia staged a coup. The Soviets blockaded Berlin, Truman sent in support by air, and Congress passed a peacetime draft. The next year, the United States signed the North Atlantic Treaty, joining with Western Europe in a military alliance to establish, in NATO, a unified front against the USSR and any further Soviet aggression. Months later, the USSR tested its first atomic bomb, and Chinese communists won a civil war. In December 1949, Mao Zedong, the chairman of China's Communist Party, visited Moscow to form an alliance with Stalin. In January, Klaus Fuchs, a German emigre scientist who had worked on the Manhattan Project, confessed that he was, in fact, a Soviet spy. Between 1949 and 1951, U.S. military spending tripled. The new spending restructured the American economy, nowhere more than in the South. By the middle of the 1950s, military spending made up close to three-quarters of the federal budget. A disproportionate amount of the spending went to southern states. The social welfare state hadn't saved the South from its long economic decline, but the national security state did. Southern politicians courted federal government contracts for defense plants, research facilities, highways, and airports. The New South led the nation in aerospace and electronics. "Our economy is no longer agricultural," the Southern writer William Faulkner observed. "Our economy is the federal government." Nixon staked his political future on becoming an instrument of the national security state. Keen to make a name for himself by ferreting out communist subversives, he gained a coveted spot on the House Un-American Activities Committee, where his early contributions included inviting the testimony of the actor Ronald Reagan, head of the Screen Actors Guild, a Californian 2 years Nixon's junior. But Nixon's real chance came when the committee sought the testimony of Time magazine's senior editor and noted anti-communist Whitaker Chambers. On August 3, 1948, Chambers, 47, told the committee that in the 1930s he'd been a communist. Time, pressured to fire Chambers, refused and published this statement. "Time was fully aware of Chambers' political background, believed in his conversion, and has never since had reason to doubt it." But if Chambers' past was no real surprise, his testimony nevertheless contained a bombshell. Chambers named as a fellow communist the distinguished veteran of the U.S. State Department, former General Secretary of the United Nations Organizing Conference, and now President of the widely respected Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, 43-year-old Alger Hiss. News that, by the next morning, was splashed across the front page of every newspaper in the country. Hiss appeared before the committee on August 25th in a televised congressional hearing. He deftly denied the charges and seemed likely to be exonerated, especially after Chambers, who came across as unstable, vengeful, and possibly unhinged, admitted that he had been a Soviet spy. At that point, Time publisher Henry Luce accepted his resignation. Chambers having presented no evidence to support his charges against Hiss, the committee was inclined to let it pass. All but Nixon, who seemed to hold a particular animus for Hiss. Rumor had it that in a closed session not seen on television, Nixon had asked Hiss to name his alma mater. "Johns Hopkins and Harvard," Hiss answered, and then added dryly, "and I believe your college is Whittier?" Nixon, who never forgave an Ivy League snub, began an exhaustive investigation, determined to catch his prey, the Sherlock Holmes to Hiss's Professor Moriarty. Meanwhile, the press and the public forgot about Hiss and turned to the upcoming election, however unexciting it appeared. Hardly anyone expected Truman to win his first full term in 1948 against the Republican presidential nominee, Thomas Dewey, governor of New York. Few Americans were excited about either candidate, but Truman's loss seemed all but inevitable. "We wish Mr. Dewey well without too much enthusiasm," Reinhold Niebuhr said days before the election, "and looked at Mr. Truman's defeat without too much regret." Truman had accomplished little of his domestic agenda, with one exception, which had the effect of alienating him from his own party. He had ordered the desegregation of the military. Aside from that, a Republican-controlled Congress had stymied nearly all of his legislative initiatives, including proposed labor reforms. Truman was so weak a candidate that two other Democrats ran against him on third-party tickets. Henry Wallace ran to Truman's left as the nominee of the Progressive Party. The New Republic ran an editorial with the headline, "Truman should quit." At the Democratic convention in Philadelphia that summer, segregationists bolted. The entire Mississippi delegation and 13 members of the Alabama delegation walked out, protesting Truman's stand on civil rights. These Southerners, known as Dixiecrats, formed the state's rights Democratic Party and ran a candidate to Truman's right. They held a nominating convention in Birmingham, during which Frank M. Dixon, a former governor of Alabama, said that Truman's civil rights programs would reduce us to the status of a mongrel inferior race mixed in blood, our Anglo-Saxon heritage, a mockery. The Dixiecrat platform rested on this statement: "We stand for the segregation of the races and the racial integrity of each race." As its candidate, the state's rights party nominated South Carolina Governor Strom Thurmond. Waving aside the challenges from Wallace and Thurmond, Truman campaigned vigorously against Dewey, running on his chief campaign pledge, a national health insurance plan. Dewey, on the other hand, proved about as good a campaigner as a pail of paint. From Kentucky, the Louisville Courier-Journal complained, "No presidential candidate in the future will be so inept that four of his major speeches can be boiled down to these historic four sentences. Agriculture is important. Our rivers are full of fish. You cannot have freedom without liberty. Our future lies ahead." Truman might have felt that the crowds were rallying to him, but every major polling organization predicted that Dewey would defeat him. Truman liked to mock leaders who paid attention to polls. "I wonder how far Moses would have got if he'd taken a poll in Egypt," he said. "What would Jesus Christ have preached if he'd taken a poll in Israel?" The week before Election Day, George Gallup issued a statement. "We have never claimed infallibility, but next Tuesday the whole world will be able to see, down to the last percentage point, how good we are." Gallup predicted that Truman would lose. The Chicago Tribune, crippled by a strike of typesetters, went to press with the headline, "Dewey defeats Truman." A victorious Truman was caught on camera 2 days later, holding up the paper and wearing a grin as wide as the Mississippi River. The 1948 election became a referendum on polling, a referendum with considerable consequences, because Congress was still debating whether or not to establish a National Science Foundation, and whether such a foundation would provide funding to social science. The pollster's error likely had to do with undercounting black votes. Gallup routinely failed to poll black people on the theory that Jim Crow, voter violence, intimidation, and poll taxes prevented most from voting. But blacks who could vote overwhelmingly cast their ballots for Truman, and probably won him the election. That was hardly the only problem with the polling industry. In 1944, Gallup had underestimated Democratic support in 2 out of every 3 states. Democrats charged that he'd engineered the poll to favor Republicans. Questioned by Congress, he'd weakly offered that, anticipating a low turnout, he'd taken 2 points off the projected vote for FDR, more or less arbitrarily. Concerned that the federal government might institute regulatory measures, the polling industry had decided to regulate itself by establishing, in 1947, the American Association for Public Opinion Research. But the criticism had continued, especially from within universities, where scholars pointed out that polling was essentially a commercial activity, cloaked in the garb of social science. The most stinging critiques came from University of Chicago sociologist Herbert Bloomer and Columbia political scientist Lindsay Rogers. "Public opinion polling is not a form of empirical inquiry," Bloomer argued, "since it skips over the crucial first step of any active inquiry, identifying what it is that is to be studied." As Bloomer pointed out, this is by no means surprising, since polling is a business, and an industry run by businessmen will create not a science, but a product. Bloomer argued that public opinion does not exist absent its measurement. Pollsters created it. Public opinion consists of what public opinion polls poll. The very idea that a quantifiable public opinion exists, Bloomer argued, rests on a series of false propositions. The opinions held by any given population are not formed as an aggregation of individual opinions, each given equal weight, as pollsters suppose, They are formed instead as a function of a society in operation. We come to hold and express the opinions that we hold and express in conversation, and especially in debate with other people and groups over time. And different people and groups influence us, and we them, in different degrees. Where Herbert Blumer argued that polling rested on a misunderstanding of empirical science, Lindsay Rogers argued that polling rested on a misunderstanding of American democracy. Rogers, a scholar of American political institutions, had started out as a journalist. In 1912, he reported on the Democratic National Convention. 3 years later, he earned a doctorate in political science from Johns Hopkins. In the 1930s, he'd served as an advisor to FDR. In 1949, in The Pollsters, Public Opinion, Politics, and Democratic Leadership, Rogers argued that he wasn't sold on polling as an empirical science, but that neither was that his particular concern. My criticism of the polls go to questions more fundamental than imperfections in sampling methods or inaccuracy in predicting the results of elections, he explained. Even if public opinion could be measured by adding up what people say in interviews over the telephone to people they've never met, legislators using this information to inform their votes in representative bodies would be inconsistent with the Constitution. Dr. Gallup wishes his polls to enable the United States to become a mammoth town meeting in which yeses and noes will suffice, Rogers wrote. He assumes that this can happen and that it will be desirable. Fortunately, both assumptions are wrong. A town meeting has to be small. Also, it requires a moderator. Decisions made in town meetings require deliberation and delay. People had said the radio would create a town meeting, too. It had not. The radio permits the population of a whole country, indeed of the world, to listen to a speaker at the same time. But there's no gathering together. Those who listen are strangers to each other. Nor, and here was Rogers's key argument, would a national town meeting be desirable? The United States has a representative government for many reasons, but among them is that it is designed to protect the rights of minorities against the tyranny of majority opinion. But as Rogers argued, the pollsters have dismissed as irrelevant the kind of political society in which we live and which we as citizens should endeavor to strengthen. That political society requires participation, deliberation, representation, and leadership, and it requires that the government protect the rights of minorities. Blumer and Rogers offered these critiques before the Dewey beats Truman travesty, but after the election, the Social Science Research Council announced that it would begin an investigation. The council, an umbrella organization, brought together economists, anthropologists, historians, political scientists, psychologists, statisticians, and sociologists. Each of these social sciences had grown dependent on the Social Science Survey, the same method used by commercial pollsters. They used weighted samples of large holes to measure attitudes and opinions. Many social scientists subscribed to rational choice theory. Newly aided by the power of computers, they used quantitative methods to search for a general theory that could account for the behavior of individuals. In 1948, political scientists at the University of Michigan found what became the American National Election Survey, the largest, most ambitious, and most significant survey of American voters. Rogers didn't object to this work, but he wasn't persuaded that counting heads is the best way to study politics, and he believed that polling was bad for American democracy. Blumer thought pollsters misunderstood science, but what many other social scientists came to believe after the disaster of the 1948 election was that if pollsters took a fall, social science would fall with them. The Social Science Research Council warned, extended controversy regarding the pre-election polls among lay and professional groups might have extensive and unjustified repercussions upon all types of opinion and attitude studies, and perhaps upon social science research generally. Its report, issued in December 1948, concluded that pollsters, led by false assumptions into believing their methods were much more accurate than in fact they are, were not up to the task of predicting a presidential election, but that the public should draw no inferences from pre-election forecasts that would disparage the accuracy or usefulness of properly conducted sampling surveys in fields in which the response does not involve expression of opinion or intention to act. That is to say, the polling industry was unsound, but social science was perfectly sound. Despite social scientists' spirited defense of their work, when the National Science Foundation was finally established in 1950, it did not include a social science division. Even before the founding of the NSF, the federal government had committed itself to fortifying the national security state by funding the physical sciences. By 1949, the Department of Defense and the Atomic Energy Commission represented 96% of all federal funds for university research in the physical sciences. Many scientists were concerned about the consequences for academic freedom. It is essential that the trend toward military domination of our universities be reversed as speedily as possible, Tu had warned. Cornell physicist Philip Morrison predicted that science under a national security state would become narrow, national, and secret. The founding of the NSF did not allay these concerns. Although the NSF's budget, capped at $15 million, was a fraction of the funds provided to scientists engaged in military research, the Office of Naval Research alone had an annual research budget of $85 million. The price for receiving an NSF grant was being subjected to a loyalty test, surveillance, and ideological oversight, and agreeing to conduct closeted research. As the Federation of